a better way. You don't have to think.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to December 8th, 2010, so a little over 14 years. This episode was episode 566, Cam Mather on Off-Grid Living. I believe it's this episode with Cam where it literally became a prophecy for me. He talked about a big storm that they had, a winter storm. And if I'm right, this is the episode where he talks about how they sent people out to check on everybody, like the sheriff or whatever. And, you know, he answers the door, all the lights are on, the house is warm. He's got a steaming hot cup of coffee in his hand. And the sheriff's out there, or whoever it is out there freezing their ass off and asking if they need anything, are they okay? Because they're doing, like, well checks on everybody. A few years later, after we had moved to Arkansas for a while, this occurred. Now, it was for different reasons. I had generators and stuff instead of a full off-grid system. But our neighbors, after 3 days, finally were able to dig their way out of the top of the mountain and head down into town to get supplies. They stopped at our place and asked if we needed anything. And it was literally the same experience, except it was Christmas time, which this episode was near. And my son was in town, and we literally had the table loaded up with, like, turkey and gravy and everything steaming. And, you know, we were just about to sit down and have dinner for Christmas. Christmas Eve, actually, I think, was the day that they were able to get out. It was either Christmas Eve or the 23rd. We were heading up to Christmas, and my son had to leave, and so we were trying to get it done before he left. And, you know, they said, do you need anything? And I went, wait a minute, because I looked in the back of their truck, and they had a gas can. Well, I had several empty gas cans, so I said, why don't you guys fill these up while you're down there? And, I guess I didn't quite convey what I was saying because, you know, a good hour later, there's a knock on the door, and I'm coming out with a glass of red wine, and we got the football game on or whatever, you know, and he's got the gas cans full of gas. I'm like, oh, no, that's for you. Bring them back to me when they're empty. And because that happened, I've never forgotten if it was this interview or the other one with Cam where that discussion happened. So I thought it was just a little good, like a breadcrumb to throw in there. Because if you listen to rewinds and stuff long enough, or even new ones, you'll probably hear about that at some point. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and flash back to December the 8th, 2010. Cam Mather on Living Off Grid. We're going to talk about how his family unplugged from the grid, moved out into a homestead, built up agricultural production, kept expanding their solar arrays and more. Two books that he wrote that are both awesome and still available. If you're interested in any of that, just go to the show notes today for Friday Flashback Episode 21, Cam Mather on Off-Grid Living. All right, folks, and with that, we've wrapped up the housekeeping, and it is now my pleasure to bring back a guest. Been on the show one time before. Always has a lot of great information with us, a lot of great things to share, and some really unique viewpoints into living sustainably, living off-grid, all of that good stuff, because he's been doing it for a long time now, and we're blessed to have Cam Mather with us today. Cam, thanks for being with us on the show.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me back.
Cam, you were on once before, but before we get into, like, your new book and some other things I want to ask you about, I do want to make sure maybe listeners that haven't gone back 150 episodes and listened to that one
know a little bit about who you are. So can you tell us, who is Cam Mather, and how'd you end up on this this farm in Ontario with 150 acres living off grid? Who were you before that? How'd you get there? Why'd you do it?
We were living in a suburban neighborhood and wanted to get out of the rat race, so we moved our house and our business out into the bush. Nearest neighbor is 4 kilometers or 4 miles away, and that's where the nearest electricity pole is. And, you know, did it because we wanted to be more independent and wanted to power our home and our business with solar power and wind power. So that was sort of the key impetus. But over the years, as we've done more and more reading and come to understand peak oil and some of the challenges with the economic collapse and climate change, we sort of decided it was time to sort of ramp it up and start making ourselves more independent. So we were fortunate that we had met a friend who doesn't live too far from us, William Kemp, and he also lived off-grid. Bill's been off-grid for almost 20 years. I've been off-grid 14 now. And Bill's an engineer who really understood renewable energy well, so we convinced him to write a book about it called The Renewable Energy Handbook. And there were books about solar power and wind power, but there was nothing that pulled it all together that had solar, wind, batteries, inverters, you know, energy efficiency, sort of the whole nine yards with how to live off-grid. So our friendship with Bill has been great, and the book has been very successful in North America because he's one of these engineers who writes in a way you can understand. And that certainly helped me in my quest to make my home more independent because, you know, I'm aware that the trick or the story with a lot of people who move off-grid is that they kind of cheat because they move off-grid, but they move on to propane. And they shift all their major loads, which are their thermal loads or their heat loads, onto propane, which is pretty easy to do, but, you know, you still need a truck to come down your driveway and deliver that propane. And propane really is the most expensive way to heat your home and heat your hot water and heat your food and cook your food. So what we have been doing over the last few years has been also trying to get ourselves off propane. And that's a tough thing if you want to live a fairly North American lifestyle. And we've been upgrading the number of solar panels we have for electricity, and that helps us do more of our cooking with electricity. We have a solar hot water heater, which is a system from a company called Dannerworks, and that preheats our water or heats most of our domestic hot water, and that reduces how much propane we need to buy for the hot water tank. So we've sort of gone through and looked at all the ways we consume energy and have been shifting them to ways that we can produce it ourselves. And it's quite challenging, and when you live in a northern climate like ours, where we are, you know, heating is one of our big challenges, but we're fortunate that we have a great wood stove that heats our home, and with 150 acres, you know, I've never really had to cut a live tree just because I can't keep up with the dead ones that are falling. So we're at a stage now where we have a propane cook stove that we use at this time of the year when there's not enough sun and wind to use electricity, and we're looking at some point at converting that to wood as well. So we would be using wood to cook, and we would also put a loop through there, and that would help us with more of our hot water, because at this time of the year when you don't have as much solar radiation, I'm still using propane to heat my hot water.
Sure. Sure. I want to hold you there for a second because I want to make sure that that Renewable Energy Handbook, I want people to know, you sent me a copy of that book, and it's probably one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. If you want to know how to do all this stuff and how to piece it together and how, I guess the big thing for me was how much money I could save by sourcing the materials and doing most of the work myself and maybe having certain things that could, you know, get you electrocuted if you're doing grid tied or whatever, done by an electrician, but only having them do that final link. That book is worth about 100 times its cover price, so I really recommend people look into that. Also, before we go further, Cam, could you kind of talk about, I want you to talk a little bit about the lifestyle change. Who were you? Like, what was your profession? You know, how did you earn your daily bread before you made this change?
Yeah, well, we had, my wife and I ran an electronic publishing business in the suburban city near Toronto where we lived. We did a lot of corporate reports and catalogs and newsletters and things like that. And, you know, the good thing about all this technology was it allowed us to move, you know, almost 4 hours away from our customers and continue to do work for them. And we started publishing a magazine on renewable energy, and that's when we met Bill, and that sort of snowballed into the book. So you know, we were very much fairly typically suburban people when our kids were born, and we still took them to Disney World and did all those sorts of things. But, you know, as time went on and we started learning more, we decided the further away from the maddening crowd we could be, the better. And as we've learned more about peak oil, we have invested more and more of the money that most people would be putting into a 401k or a retirement fund. We've been investing into hard assets, and that's what I really talk about in Thriving During Challenging Times, things like solar panels, things that will actually do something for you. And so many times I have a wind turbine where I am, and I'm not in the best location because I'm in a fairly wooded area, but it's on a 100-foot tower, and it's clearing the tree line by about 30 or 40 feet. When I talk to people about the wind turbine, I say, you know, the turbine was $3,000, the tower was $3,000, I put $1,600 worth of concrete in the anchors, $700 worth of cabling to get it wired in. By the time I was done, I was $8,000 or $9,000 on this wind turbine, and which from one perspective is stupid, because it would be much much cheaper for me to just buy gasoline and use gasoline or diesel fuel and run a generator for the times that I don't have enough sun. And the fall is one of those typical times in my climate. It's a lot of cloudy days. But the nice thing is those cloudy days in the fall tend to have a lot of wind. So yeah, it would have been better to continue to buy gas. But quite honestly, I see a day, number one, when gas is going to be outrageously expensive, and number two, when I might not be able to get it. And I'm at a stage where my lifestyle is such that, you know, all the things that were going in the garden, some of it ends up in a freezer. And I need electricity to keep that freezer going, to keep all that hard-earned food that I've grown cold, so I can eat it all winter. So we sort of have made some of those choices. You know, a lot of people would say, geez, $9,000 or $10,000, that'd buy a nice granite countertop. And sure it would, and our kitchen would look much nicer with the granite countertop, but I can tell you, on a windy night in November, when I haven't seen the sun for a week, but when my wind turbine is screaming away up there charging my batteries when I'm sleeping, it's the best sound in the world, and there's nothing nicer than to get up and know that your batteries are going to be charged, and the freezer's going to be working, and the pump's going to be pumping water, and the computers are going to be working, and the refrigerator's working, and the TV's working, and the lights are working. Everything's working, and I haven't had to rely on a single other person for that. I do it all myself. It's a really freeing experience. It's very, very empowering, and I absolutely love it. You know, we've been doing this 14 years now, and I still stand out there and look at these solar panels and marvel at this wind turbine and say, wow, I can't believe I can do this, but it's pretty cool.
Not to mention with the wind turbine, there's in that system you just described, there is a few things that are parts of it that can break down over time and need to be replaced. The generator itself may at some point need replacement. That might be 15 years, it might be 30 years. I guess it depends on the quality of the item that went in. Maybe the vanes eventually, maybe the turbine itself needs to be replaced. But, I mean, the tower, the concrete, the wiring, that has an infrastructure life greater than a human being. So it's a lifetime investment on the majority of the infrastructure. And, you know, any engineer is going to tell you the infrastructure is the expensive part of most things. So that's there forever. And like you said, instead of putting money in your 401k, hoping to God it doesn't crash to the ground, hoping to God that inflation works and pushes the value up, and that when you're 65, you can use it to buy electricity to heat your little condo, you know, or wherever you're at that point because you've lived that lifestyle. Your wind turbine's just sitting there, whoop, 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 and it's just putting out power day after day after day after day. So it might be cheaper short-term is what I'm saying, but across your lifetime, and I mean, you're building something you can leave to your kids one day, right?
No question about it, and that's one of the things I really push with solar panels is the fact that, you know, you're leaving your kids a legacy. A solar panel you buy today is going to come with a 25- or 30-year warranty. So any manufacturer that will give you a 30-year warranty on a product knows that it's going to last a lot longer than that. Now, the wind turbine I bought is a Berge. The company's from Oklahoma. It's, I think, one of the better engineered wind turbines out there, but you're right. It does have moving parts, and it's more likely to break. And I'm quite honestly at a stage where, you know, the next time I have $3,000 around and the warranty has run out on that Berge, you know, maybe it's time I look at buying another one and putting it away, putting it in a box, and if this one breaks, bring it down and use it for spare parts, hoping that I can have the, you know, a comparable model number.
You know, your thing on the solar panels, what I've learned is there's tons of people out there that with 20-year-old panels yanking them off the roof, Not because they don't work, because they can buy more efficient panels now. And you can buy those things used, and you stick them up on your roof, and they put power out almost as good as the day they were made.
Yep. And the beauty, and I hate to say it, the good thing about the economic collapse was that, you know, and in 2008, up until that time, you had Germany and Japan and California and all these places with great incentives. So you had a huge ramp up in production. Then you had the economic collapse, and suddenly there was a huge supply of solar panels in the market that weren't going sold, so the prices dropped significantly. So to me, now's the time to be buying these things. If you still got a job and you still got the money to do it, you know, you shouldn't be buying that granite countertop. You should be buying solar panels. I think that's where you should be investing your money.
I agree with you, because granite countertop, yeah, granted, it looks great, but it can't feed you, and it don't keep you warm. If you lay on one, it'll pull the heat rate out of your body, which maybe it's useful down here, at least because my you know, your big expense is heating. My big expense is cooling when it's 118,000 degrees outside. But you're right. I mean, we're looking at the improvements we're going to do at our place in Arkansas when we move, and we look at it, we go, our countertops are just cruddy, and we do want to fix them up, but we'll use, you know, low-cost tile and do the work ourselves, and we'll put the money into things like alternative energy, because the countertop's where we cut our sandwich up, but our electricity is how we cook the meat that goes between the bread.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, I was fortunate. When I put up my turbine, I used a tower called a gin pole, and I can bring the wind turbine down in about 20 minutes. I have a DeWalt cordless drill, an 18-volt cordless drill. I can bring the turbine down with two batteries, and I can put it up with four batteries. There's a little more, you know, a little more energy required when you're putting it up, but it's a very efficient winch. The nice thing about that is if it was to break, it's easy to bring down, and if you're in a hurricane-prone zone, although any wind turbine you purchase today is going to have the ability to furl or stall so that it should be able to, you know, withstand very high winds, I know that I can bring mine down in pretty short order so that that I'll be able to preserve that asset if a big storm's blowing through.
Awesome. And by the way, folks, you just heard one of the best investments I can recommend there. If you're going to buy electric tools, buy DeWalt and an 18-volt cordless drill. I've had one for 15 years that was given to me by a cable guy who dropped it off of a pole and put a chunk out of it and decided since his company would replace it, he could just give it away. And I don't know how long he used it, and I burned through some batteries in it, but I still use that thing all the time. So if you're going to buy a tool, buy the best. When you're looking to do the things that you're talking about, you're moving to solar and wind, but you're some guy living in the middle of Arlington, Texas, like me, and you don't have the money to do this full scale right away. Maybe it's not in the cards. You're going to move off grid. What are some steps people can take to kind of get started with solar and wind at a smaller level and then build it in a way that it can be expanded?
Well, step number one is always energy efficiency. You know, the cheapest energy is energy you save. So you should be spending your money on energy efficient light bulbs and energy efficient appliances. Get the EnerStar logo, use the EnerGuide to make sure you get the appliances that consume the least amount of energy. Because it doesn't matter what the product costs, it's the life cycle cost, what it costs to operate over its life. And as the cost of energy goes up, which it will, you know, the less energy a product uses, the better. So it's the least sexy part of renewable energy, but it's the thing you got to do first. And then after you've done energy efficiency, down where you are, the quickest return on investment is going to be solar thermal. So it's using the sun for heat rather than for electricity. So that's putting a panel on your roof for hot water, or putting in a wood stove if you're in a cooler environment, or putting in a geothermal system. And, you know, if you put up a solar domestic hot water system, probably cost you about $5,000. A lot of utilities will give you incentives. There's a federal incentive from the U.S. government, and there some states have them and some municipalities do, because they know where we're at with natural gas. They know we're running out of it, and it's going to be more expensive, and they want you to use less of it. So, you know, putting up a solar domestic hot water heater is going to probably give you, depending on where you live, we'll say 60% of your hot water for free. $5,000 investment, probably going to be paid off within 5 years, so it's a 20% return on investment. So, you know, right now, if you're looking, if you got some money to put aside and you're putting it in a, you know, in a bond or a savings account, what are you earning? 1.5%, 2%? You're getting 20% when you start investing in some of this solar equipment. And in terms of getting into solar electric and using the sun for electricity, one of the key systems that any of the key parts of the system is going to be the inverter. It's the box that converts the DC electricity that the solar panel makes to AC that your household is going to want. So I would suggest you invest in a good one of those, spend a couple $1,000 on a good inverter, and only get one panel and one small battery to start. You can always upgrade the solar panels, you can always upgrade the batteries, but get a good inverter that will allow you to expand. And, you know, next year when you get $1,000 back in your income tax, buy some solar panels. You know, 2 years from now when Uncle Harry dies and leaves you $5,000, buy more solar panels. You can keep upgrading the system, providing that you've invested in a good inverter to start. And if that's still out of your price range, you should be looking at even one of these battery boxes that you can buy. A lot of, home hardware stores and lumber yards will sell them. There'll be a battery with an inverter built in. And they'll tend to have a picture on the side that'll say, if the power goes out, this will keep a cell phone on for 40 hours or a fridge running for 3 hours or whatever. And get yourself one of those, because the nice thing will be if you're not prepared, if you don't have enough things charged up, it'll be nice to still be able to use your cell phone. And the other thing in terms of, that I always talk about with people in terms of cell phone is if you have a cell phone, learn how to text message. Because what happens in a lot of emergencies like earthquakes and things is that the voice network will go down, but you'll still be able to send text messages. It uses less of energy, and it's in a lower bandwidth, I think. So a lot of times people aren't able to call each other on cell phones, but they're able to text. And this sounds a little crazy, but I was telling people to do this for years, and I could never figure out how to do it on my own cell phone. But if you can learn to text, you're going to have that ability to communicate with people that you're trying to get in touch with. And if you've got a little battery box with a little inverter built in, you'll be able to charge that cell phone. So it will give you contact with the outside world in the event there was a situation that none of us hope happened, but that can happen.
Well, first of all, one thing you can keep in your emergency kit, if you need to make sure you can text, is a 14-year-old girl. And she'll take care of that for your texting needs. But on the backup battery system, there's a product called the PowerDome EX. We have four of them. We have one in every vehicle, and we bring one in a week and make sure it's fully charged and keep, rotate them through that way. And it's $100. And if you don't have one of those in your vehicle, I think you're wrong. I mean, it saved us so many times. I've been able to find people stuck in a parking lot, jump their vehicle for them. And, yeah, I could do that with jumper cables, but if they had one of these, they don't even need another car. I did a test, and it ran a laptop computer with the battery pulled, so it's full draw, running a DVD and a fan for about an hour and a half, and that's quite a bit of draw there. So those products will do that. But the other thing I've been telling people, and you tell me if I'm oversimplifying this, if you go out and get yourself two good marine-grade, deep cycle batteries and put them in one of those Rubbermaid rollable toolboxes, wire them together, keep them at 12 volts, put a good inverter on the other side of that. And this is not maybe one of your household level inverters, but like a 750 watt inverter, that type of thing, on the outside of the box, wire that through, get yourself a charge controller and a 60 watt solar panel off of eBay. That is, in essence, a mini house. And if you know how to do that and you get the experience from that, putting it in a house is just doing more and bigger.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. I agree, and it's good that you pointed out you should get a charge controller. It's easy to overcharge those, so spend $20 or $30 on a good little charge controller just to keep from frying your batteries, and that's a brilliant way to do it. And it's all scalable. And like you said, by doing that, you're getting the experience you need to as you ramp up and add more panels or a new battery bank, etc. later on. So that's a great way to do it.
I've even got some free solar panels, Cam, and the way I've been able to do that is, if you look, a lot of times you'll see these street signs, and they're not big panels. They might be a 20-watt panel or whatever, but they're free. You'll see these street signs that have panels on them, and usually they're leased. And I picked this up on some ebook I got online, and if you look at the back, you'll find the name of the company leasing that to the city or the county or the highway construction company. And a lot of times if you call that company up and ask them if they have any damaged ones, they'll say, yeah, we got a few, and they'll give them to you. And they might not quite put out full output, but for building small backup systems, you can piece that together for nothing. And I thought that was one of the coolest things that I'd ever come by. So your rules are basically start with efficiency, then move to thermal. Think about things like hot water heating. You tell people how much of your – because people talk about changing light bulbs. And I was shocked at how little lighting costs, really, compared to something like heating my hot water. What's the difference there?
Well, you're probably looking at in a northern climate, and that's just the latest data I've seen. probably 60% of your energy is going to be for heating your home, and then you're going to get, 20% for cooling, and then you start going down for that, hot water, appliances, et cetera. So officially, technically, lighting and energy efficient appliances are not going to be a large percentage of your overall household energy requirements. And that's the cool thing about what you've suggested with your system, that by having a minimal investment in something like that, you can keep the lights on quite comfortably. And you don't have to go out and buy the LED lights, which are really expensive. You should just be buying the compact fluorescents.
Yeah, I agree.
There's one thing I suggest to a lot of people as well is if they're looking at doing this seriously, and if they're not an electrician, they might want to get an electrician in and separate out their panel boxes so you have two panel boxes. One is essential loads and one is non-essential loads. So if you've got that little battery backup, it would be powering your essential loads, which would be lighting, radio or television to have an idea what's happening. If your battery bank is big enough and you're living in a rural environment, it would power your pump. That's going to be quite a big draw, but you may want to get a generator tied into that. And then you'd have your non-essential loads, which would be your dishwasher and your clothes washer. You know, if the power's out for a week, you don't need to wash your clothes. You know, you're going to get a little smelly, but that's a big demand that you don't require. And the beauty of having your house wired that way is that in the event of an extended power outage, that you're going to keep lights on and freezers working and things like that. And, you have them in hurricanes and tornadoes and things when they blow through, and sometimes they can be fairly extensive. But, up here where I am, in 10 years ago, there was a large ice storm. And you had, 50 million people in the northern U.S. and in Ontario and Quebec without electricity. And, when I do a lot of my workshops on solar and wind, it's amazing how many people I talk to, and I'll say how many people were without power for 3 days and everybody's hand will go up, and how many people were without power for 2 weeks, lots of hands go up, and some of them are 17 days and more. And then you ask people, well, what have you done? And most of them haven't done anything. You say, haven't bought a generator? No. There's this sort of human inertia that says, well, it's not going to happen again. Well, it is going to happen again, and there's no excuse for you not to be prepared now. To the extent where during the ice storm, within 3 days, the military had been called out, people are in really dire straits. They can't keep their house warm. The pipes are freezing. They can't eat. They can't bathe. It's a major disaster. Well, when the military knocks on Bill Kemp's door, my friend who wrote the Renewable Energy Handbook, Bill lives off-grid like I do, he heats with a wood stove, he opens his door, heat comes piling out because of his wood stove, Bill's standing there in his bathrobe because he just had a shower, he's got Beethoven playing in the background, and he's got a steaming hot cup of coffee, and the military guys sort of look at their clipboard and say, well, we have to ask, is everybody in the house okay? Yeah. What's the problem, sir?
They'd probably like to come in, honestly.
we have this technology. It's just that most people choose to take their income and give it to somebody else to get their natural gas for their hot water and somebody else for their electricity, and they pay somebody else for their food, and they take all these essential things that our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents did themselves, and we give those people our money. And I think it's time you start taking your money and putting it into solar panels and putting it into all the things that make you independent again. It's really important, and you almost need a shock like an ice storm to wake you up. And a lot of people don't respond to it, but I'm sure lots of people that listen to your podcast are doing that, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. And I want to switch gears in here and talk about feeding ourselves here in just a second, but I want to kind of put it in perspective for folks. There's five things that they say you need to survive, and one's food, one's shelter, one's water, one's fire, and one's security. Now, I've changed that. I call fire energy, because this is a wilderness survival tenet, but when it comes down to living in our homes, fire represents heat, it represents power, it represents energy. So we've been really focused on the energy. We've definitely been focused on the shelter because of, all the energy efficiency things. We're talking about making sure that our shelters are sound. Let's move and talk about food and water for a bit. Let's talk about food, in fact, because you have it's not brand new, but it's a pretty new book out called The All You Can Eat Gardening Handbook. And I've read that. I think that's a phenomenal book. I've been saying since almost day one of the show, people need to learn how to feed themselves again and get connected to the food supply and realize that food doesn't come in a box and a package. You've kind of even taken that to a, you have a really big, I wouldn't call it a garden, I'd say it's a mini farm. Tell us about what you're doing there, why you're doing it, that type of thing.
Well, I've been gardening for 35 years, and when I was living in the suburbs, I had some big black walnut trees in the backyard and couldn't grow anything in the backyard, and started out growing a few tomato plants in my front yard, and by the time the garden had expanded to the point where I had corn growing in my front yard, I decided it was time to move out to the country. So, I mean, I've always loved gardening, but I think there's a real urgency right now for people to start acquiring these skills. And I don't think gardening is overly complicated, but gardening takes time. You need to do it a lot, and you need to make a lot of mistakes to know when to put things in and what to put in and all those other things. So I just talked to a lot of people, and I said, that doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter how big your garden is. If you're in an apartment right now, get yourself some containers. If you're in a townhouse and you've got a small garden, it doesn't matter. Just get something in the ground. And I have, you know, sort of steadily expanded my garden over the years, and I'm at a stage now where, you know, I sell some of my vegetables, so it's somewhat of a market garden, but I tend to focus on the things that store the best. And that's been my focus over the last few years. And that's why, you know, when you read my gardening book, you get to the potato section. You know, the potato section is probably the biggest section in it in terms of what to grow. And, you know, the beauty of potatoes is, number one, they're easy to grow. You can grow them anywhere. And they're a great source of protein that stores really well. And the thing I like about potatoes is that every year I put 15 or 20 buckets down in my root cellar, and the ones that don't get eaten in the winter are the seed potatoes that I use for the following year. So it's one of those things where it's a very inexpensive way to grow, you know, good food that will keep you going. And it's one of the things that that the Russians, you know, one of the reasons they were able to survive the collapse of the Soviet Union was because, you know, most Russians had a little plot in the country, and they had a couple of chickens, and they could get some eggs, and they could grow potatoes that they could store through the winter. So it's concentrating things like that that are easy, inexpensive protein that store well, and that's sort of one of the focuses of the book. You know, I did an interesting experiment this summer. I grew a fairly large plot of wheat. Because I like bread and I like pasta, and I said, yeah, I mean, I eat a lot of this stuff. I should figure out about growing wheat. So I had about a 900 square foot patch of wheat that I grew, and then I harvested it. And you know, of course, you have to thresh it to get it off the stalks, and then you have to winnow it to get the husks off. And I was just blown away with how much energy is involved with getting protein from wheat. It's staggering. And now anytime I see a combine harvester, I'm just in awe of what this machine does and how much of our diet, you know, you hear this statistic that, you know, for every calorie of food energy you eat, 10 calories of fossil fuel energy have gone into it. But after growing my own wheat, I understand because a 7-ton combine harvester is a factory on wheels out in a farmer's field. And to do that all manually is quite staggering. So, you know, it at some point in the future, you're going to want to have sort of a diverse way to feed yourself. Part of it is going to be getting protein from things like grain. Part of it is going to be getting protein from things like potatoes. And in a good mixed environment, there's going to be some animal protein there as well from your chickens, et cetera. And the nice thing about having those chickens is that they're going to scratch around in the garden, and they're going to be eating grubs and slugs and some of those nasty animals and pests that you don't want in there, and be providing you from, you know, providing you with eggs and meat if that's something you want down the road, and a great way to get rid of your compost. I mean, they can be fairly inexpensive to feed that way. So that's sort of the stage we're at right now. I continue to make the gardens bigger. I've been investing a lot in fruit, like strawberries and raspberries. This year I got into high bush blueberries. You know, I mean, we still like muffins and banana bread with blueberries and stuff. So put in some blueberry plants, and blueberries like a very acidic soil. So one of the things I talk about in the book is how to get the most value in terms of ways to build up your soil for the cheapest way. So every time I'm in the local city, Kingston, that I go to periodically, I hit every Starbucks store and I grab their coffee grounds. Coffee grounds are very acidic. They make your soil very acidic, and that's what blueberry plants love. So, you know, I come home from Kingston with 200 pounds of free fertilizer for my blueberries. And the thing that I notice right now in the city that I go to is that the leaves are all off the trees. So, you know, every second house has 10 wonderful bags of leaves out front. Now, I don't need them right now because I get horse manure from a neighbor, but if I was living in the city, I'd be saying, holy man, people are throwing out all this compost. And they don't know it. It's not compost yet, but it's there. So, I mean, if I'd have a trailer on my Honda Civic, and I would be hauling that stuff into my yard, and I'd have the biggest compost pile you could imagine. I mean, I did this in the city when I lived there, and I probably would compost about 150 bags of leaves.
That everybody else is throwing away, right? I mean, that's, you're taking what people see as garbage and realizing its inherent worth. Before I let you go further, I want to talk about a couple of things you've mentioned there to drive it home for people. One is you talked about you got to make mistakes and you got to screw up and you got to do it yourself. I can't overstate how accurate that is. Even if you have someone that you know near you that's growing things, it's going to be different on your property. I have a good friend named Brian. He lives about 10 miles away from me. He had trouble with peppers early in the year getting them grow. I got them so big the plants are breaking. I got bell peppers the size of small pumpkins. But I couldn't get squash to grow for anything here because of vine borers. He's never seen a vine borer. We're 10 miles away. Completely different crops are successful or failing when our soil conditions are quite similar. There's just little nuances. And my vine borer problem's probably because there's a lot of squash growers around me where he doesn't have that many. And all types of things like that, man, you're not gonna know those things until you do. And then the other thing with the leaves you were talking about there at the end, if you want to speed that process up, you can run a lawnmower over there a couple times, and that really accelerates that. If you mix green, what I do is I grow clover in my backyard, and I have these big patches of it where it's taking over the grass, and people think that's, you know, that's not the prettiest suburban lawn, but it's effective and it's high nitrogen. And we'll mix a bag of shredded leaves with two bags of shredded leaves to one bag full of that clover. And oh my God, that breaks down in like, I'd say about 5 weeks. It's compost.
Perfect. Yeah, and that's exactly what you should be doing. The clover is very high in nitrogen. Leaves are high in carbon, and ratio of 1:2 or 1:3 is just perfect. So no, that's exactly what you should be doing. And the other thing you were talking about in terms of, you know, the squash vine borers and things like that is that, you know, I think a lot of people think, well, man, I'm not going to be able to grow enough food for myself. I'm intimidated to even get started. And the problem with that attitude is that the smaller your garden, probably the more success you're going to have. You know, when you got half an acre like I do, I just don't have the proper time to get around and be examining the plants the way I should. You know, this year I had a real problem with slugs because we've had two wet summers in a row. Before I was having brutally hot summers, and I never had a problem with slugs. So, you know, if you got a small garden, you've got the time to get out there and look at those tomato plants and look at those beans and see how they're doing. And sure enough, if you know some of the leaves are turning yellow, do a little research. Do I need to water them more? Am I watering them too much, or maybe am I not giving them enough nitrogen? Maybe I should be getting a little more of those grass clippings from the neighbor that I see them putting out in the garbage every week. So if anything, the smaller the garden to start, the better. Because the other thing I find is a lot of people bite off way more than they can chew. And they get out there and they rent a rototiller and they make this humongous garden the first year that they're into it. And they get it in. There's huge enthusiasm in the spring. And then all summer they realize, holy crap, I gotta keep weeding these things. And I gotta keep watering. And then by the fall they say, I'm never gonna grow any food again. It was just too much darn work.
There's some other things you were talking about there with protein. And then to me, this is a big part where small livestock or even harvestable local wildlife come in to the play. The reality is if you look at a big field of grass and mixed herbs and things like that, typical pasture land, there's a tremendous amount of protein there, and there's a huge amount of potential protein there. But human beings, we just have not evolved to eat, you know, pasture and convert it to protein. But things like rabbits and goats and cattle and all types of creatures are really good at converting that biomass into high-quality protein. And we can bring things in, and we don't even have to necessarily be harvesting the wildlife itself. Like you said, chickens, turkeys, ducks, a lot, especially like the khaki, what do they call them, the khaki something. They're like a mallard cross with some kind of domestic duck. Really good in land situations. They'll convert that biomass to protein in the form of eggs. So by bringing in some stuff that we'll harvest, like let's say I'm looking at, just by the way, like 17 mourning doves probably and about half a dozen squirrels sitting in my backyard at my feeders right now. In a hard time, they could all be potential protein. But we could also be raising rabbits or killing some of our chickens and ducks, the surplus, that takes that one resource that's good to look at, but we can't do a lot with it, and it makes it something we can eat, right?
I agree, and you know, a lot of cities now are aware of the fact that that people are thinking these terms, and it used to be, you know, most cities and suburbs would make it illegal to have chickens, but a lot of big cities now are making it legal that, you know, to have, you know, three or four chickens in your backyard. And, you know, we don't have any right now, but they seem to have great personalities. People really, really enjoy having them around. Everybody who eats fresh eggs raves about them, and they can't believe how much better they are than the kind you get in the stores. And they're certainly much safer, I mean, in terms of you knowing that, you know, problems that you might have with salmonella and stuff. But I just think any time you have contact like that with animals and nature, and you produce your own food, I think it just gives you a huge appreciation. And, you know, I grow a lot of my own food. I don't grow at all. And I still, you know, I still spoil myself. I eat the odd pineapple. I eat the odd banana. They've come a long way. They have a high carbon footprint. A lot of energy is gone into getting them to my place. But, you know, I sit down and I marvel at the fact that I can buy a pineapple where I am, and the grocery store is about 10 miles from me, and, you know, in the middle of winter, I can buy a pineapple for $3, and I think it's a miracle. And the one thing I've learned in all the research I've done, I also realize it's a real privilege. It's a real right. A lot of people assume it's a right to have this a multitude of food available to them 12 months of the year, and it's not. It's a privilege. And by growing your own food and getting a handle on where it comes from and how much energy has gone into growing it, I think you actually start enjoying the food that you eat more. And I think that's really important, because as people learn about peak oil and a lot of these issues, it can be depressing and it can be overwhelming. But I honestly think, and it's one of the things that I stressed in my book, Thriving During Challenging Times, I think that it's a real opportunity for people to do things that they actually enjoy that make them happy. Rather than sitting in some, you know, geofattening pen and on a telephone pushing pixels around a computer screen all day, getting out in your garden and growing your own food and bringing it in and putting it on your table and eating something you've grown just gives you a tremendous feeling of accomplishment. It's a wonderful experience. And so I think that when people come to my workshops and stuff, I think they assume that I'm going to sort of walk around with a dark cloud over my head, but it's just not the case. I love my wind turbine, and I love my garden, and I love Sunday morning when I'm having a big plate of hash browns and onions from my garden and locally grown eggs. It's a good thing.
You know, and what you talked about there with, eating some pineapples or bananas or things like that, the thing with that is, first of all, you're only going to eat so many pineapples and bananas, or you're going to spend more time in the bathroom than in the backyard, so it's self-limiting. But I guess the other thing is, that's the stuff to me that it makes sense for me to eat from, you know, a tropical climate. Now, buying my corn from a tropical climate doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because I can grow all the corn I want right here. So if we were only importing in significant quantities the things we can't produce for ourselves, then we would tend to be exporting the things that we can produce in surplus, and it seems to me we'd have much more balanced trade. And there's nothing wrong with eating a pineapple that was grown in the Pacific Islands. That's a commodity that those people are able to sell and earn a living with, and there's nothing wrong with selling them things that don't grow good on a sandy island like a good old ear of corn. But to me, the problem is that most of us are now eating more than half of our foods coming from Argentina, Australia, and no harm, no foul. I don't hate Australians or Argentinians. I love them both. They're great people. But we become dependent instead of trade partners.
Yep. And I think one of the things that doing, you know, knowing where your food comes from and sourcing it and growing it yourself and knowing how much effort went into growing it, I think it gives you a much better appreciation for the people who I think are the most important people in our society, and that's farmers. You know, I think that people living in an urban environment, I think they're, in a lot of cases, there's a blue state and a red state mentality, and I think these things are wrong, because what you realize is that, you know, we're all dependent on other people, and increasingly we're dependent on these farmers on tractors feeding more and more people every year. So you need to realize there's only so much they can do, and as the price of energy goes up, what they produce is going to be much more expensive. So how much you can take out of your backyard is going to become really important.
I also think we would actually pay our farmers more per labor unit if we grew more of our own food, which most people think is completely wrong, but I think it's completely right. What I mean by that is, let's say I'm growing 50% of my food that I have to have, or 50% of the food that I eat in my backyard. But that gives me, you know, honestly 60 or 70% of the food that I need to subsist and need to survive. That means I only have to go out on the market and buy 30 or 40% of the food to make myself alive, right? Any additional food that I buy, now I'm buying a pineapple because I like sweetness and I like that pineapple that I can't. So I'm buying kind of a luxury, right? So do people pay more money per unit for things they have to have, or do people pay more money per unit for luxuries? And the obvious answer is a luxury. So if we take some portion of our food and stop looking at it as I got to eat tonight or I'm going to die, and start saying, oh, I can feed myself in the backyard, but I want this pineapple, or I want this papaya, or I want this cup of coffee grown in Sumatra. People are actually going to be willing to pay more for the reduced quantity, if this makes sense, the reduced quantity they actually buy, which means everybody in that labor chain is able to make more per unit, and it's actually better for our farmers if we buy less from them. I know that sounds retarded, but I mean, to me, it's completely, it makes complete financial sense.
Yep, no question about it. I also think that one of the nice things about starting to grow food now on a small scale is it gets you in touch with challenges that you're going to have in the future, such as water. You know, so much of the world, including the southern U.S., has challenges with water. So, you get that little garden in, and you know, you realize that your local municipality is telling you to use less water. So now you're going to go out and you're going to put rain barrels on every downspout, and when you do get a rain, you're going to save as much of that water as you can. If you're in a rural environment and you've got a pump, you're going to realize that every time that pump comes on to pump water out of your well, it uses electricity. So you're going to make sure that you use the water very efficiently. And I have a really sandy soil, and I'm in a very drought-prone area. So I find that one of my biggest challenges with growing well is water. So what I have done is, number one, I have a dug well, which is a well that the previous farmer, 75 years ago, dug down near where my garden is. And I used to, when I started, I just throw a bucket down and pull it up and take it over to where I wanted to water it. But now that I'm 50, that's too much work. So I've got a solar panel and a little DC pump that I just bought at an auto supply place, with a pipe that goes down into the well with a foot valve in it to keep it from plugging up. And I use that to pull the water out of the well and move it out into the garden, some of which I put in rain barrels. Nice thing about that is I put it in a rain barrel one day, I let it warm up so that when I use it the next day, it's going to shock the plants a little less. And I'm also now using a drip irrigation system. So what I purchased is a series of piping that has small holes drilled basically every 12 inches, and when the water is being pushed through there, it just drips out of those holes. And it's way, way more efficient than using a sprinkler. When you use a sprinkler, a huge percentage of the water vaporizes, and a lot of it ends up where you don't want it, and all it does is ends up between the rows, and it inspires weeds to grow. When you use drip irrigation, you put it right to where you want it, right to the plant, and what happens is that little dripping water sort of looks like if you had a towel and you dipped the corner of a towel in water, a big fluffy towel, if you kept doing that and dipping it in for a second, eventually you know that towel is going to suck that water all the way up into the towel. And that's what your ground is going to do. It's sort of going to whip that water and move it to where you want it to go. And it's not going to waste it because it's all going directly to the plant rather than into the air. So, you know, I've sort of invested, $50 a year for the last few years and increased the amount of piping that I have for my drip irrigation. And now when I do have those drought periods, I've got a way to keep things watered. And you can do this on a small scale as well. It's not something you have to do if you have a huge commercial garden. You can do it on a much smaller scale. So this is the nice thing about getting a little garden in and getting it, as you say, getting it going and finding out what the challenges are that are unique to your area so that you can make your mistakes now so that when it's necessary, when your kids move back home because they've lost their job and now you're feeding a few more people and you want to start offsetting some of those food costs, you've now got the skills to do it.
Very cool. Also, I wanted to drop this on you and see what your thoughts are. You may or may not have heard this before. One of my idols out there is Bill Mollison, one of the founders of permaculture. And I was listening to one of his lectures, and he said something about water conservation that changed forever the way I look at a forest. He said our forests are actually lakes. And he said it's a combination of the shade that prevents evaporation, the massive amount of organic matter that falls on our forest floors and goes into a moist, slow breakdown process with the fungi, and all the moisture that's retained by that soil. Even though the trees are pumping massive amounts of water, there's still a lot of surface water there. And if you took a forest and you spread it out over 1,000 or 1,000,000 acres, there's in the first 12 inches of soil, there's about an inch of water. And that's a one-inch deep, million-acre lake. And that we can take and we can recreate those conditions on a quarter of an acre in a little patch of, you know, shrubs and brushes and vines and trees like apple trees, blueberry bushes, climbing vines, things like that in our backyards. We can't do as good as nature in that small climate because any kind of ecosystem, the smaller you go, the less stable it is. But we can recreate that, and that we can conserve water without actually doing it the way that normally people think of it. When I looked at that, I was like, I mean, you would never even think of it in that fashion. So now we take your drip irrigation water catchment system and we put it into something like that. We get something that we have a reserve of water. We don't even see it as water. We see it as soil, but the water's there.
Yes, and I mean, what you're talking about as well is something that I try and emulate in my gardens, which is using mulch.
Absolutely.
Putting something on to maintain the water that's already there. And, you know, I'm fortunate because I live in a rural area and I purchase, scrap round bales from farmers, hay that's no longer suitable to feed livestock. But I'll go back to those leaves that you're scrounging from your neighbor in the city. They make a fabulous mulch. You know, get them under your tomato plants. Get them under everything. And they're going to do two things. Number one, they're going to keep the weeds down and they're going to keep the water in. And they're also going to start breaking down and adding the nutrients and the humus that you need that's going to improve the soil. Because, you know, earthworms are going to crawl up into those leaves and they're going to munch on some and pull some down into the soil. And that's going to create air holes in your garden. And that's what your roots like. And that's when you have a rain, what the water wants to flow through. So the more of that organic matter you can get into your garden, the better.
And awesome.
Anything that you can get the tree, I think, is really important.
Yeah, my one neighbor's actually got this thing. Looks like a leaf blower, but it works like a vacuum. And he put a standard garbage bag on the back side of it, and it sucks up the leaves, shreds them, and compacts them into the bag. And he was out last year. Believe it or not, our leaves are still just beginning to fall from our trees down here. It's been such a warm year. But last year, I mean, he ended up with his whole yard into about four bags, and I wondered how that could happen. And when I picked one bag up, and it near ripped my back out, I realized how much was actually packed in there. But I took those four bags of leaves, and when I put them into a pile and they pop back out, I had this massive, and so I don't remember who makes this thing, but I got to find out, because I think for a suburban person, it's a great tool. I think neighbors could go in on one together. I mean, how often do you need it? It's not something you need every day. So a couple neighbors could go in on one together, but you're right. The more you can get for free, and the more you can do nature's job of breaking it down before you put it into the compost heap, the quicker the results you're going to get.
I like that idea.
We've been talking a lot about food now. We've been talking about water. We've been talking about shelter, energy. Let's talk about surplus food. So I go out, and I can tell you from my personal experience, my garden's much smaller than yours just because of spatial requirements. But I produce way more food, not that I can eat in a year, but that I could eat in a growing season.
Right.
We had our first frost the day of Thanksgiving, so I had to go out and pull all my sweet peppers, all my chili peppers, all my jalapenos, all of my peppers. I got about 50 pounds of peppers in one day. And I know what I did with it, but not everybody's going to have peppers in surplus. You talk a lot about preserving your own food through some different methods in your book. Can you go through some of those, the advantages and disadvantages of each?
Sure. Peppers and tomatoes and things like that, they obviously they can very well. And if you're going to can, I suggest you find somebody who knows how to do it well, and because it can be dangerous if you don't do it well. Not as dangerous with things like tomatoes that are very acidic, but things like beans and stuff. If you don't do it properly, you can end up with botulism, and that can be dangerous. The other thing I'm always thinking about with canning is the fact that I always look at the energy that's required to do it. And at this stage of the game, I think canning skills are good skills to have, but if you look at the cost of energy versus what it costs to go out and buy a can of tomatoes, I think we're at a stage where we have this amazing economic system that still provides an abundant amount of food very cheap. So, you know, one of the things I talk about in Thriving During Challenging Times is to have a pantry. And anytime, you know, canned tomatoes are on sale, stock up and fill up your pantry. So I think it's very, very important to have the skill of how to can. But right now, I tend to look at things more such as freezing. And with a lot of our tomatoes, what we do is Michelle blanches them, just throws them into hot water quickly, takes the skins off, throws them into plastic bags, and then we freeze them. And then what we do during the winter is just pull out a bag, put it on the wood stove, throw in some garlic and frozen basil, and, you know, you've got soup by lunchtime. So freezing from an off-grid standpoint, a lot of people wouldn't think that you could have the electricity to do it, but we continue to invest in more solar panels. We've upgraded our battery bank, and we have a farmhouse that was built in 1888, so the basement isn't heated. So the basement stays quite cool, and that's where our freezer is. So it doesn't have to work as hard.
And if you correct me if I'm wrong, too, Cam, I think that chest freezers, especially a good-sized chest freezer, well-stocked, not half-empty, in a cool environment, is far more energy efficient than a standard refrigerator is.
Yes, most definitely. And that's certainly what we discovered when we bought our freezer. And, you know, we were always frustrated when we had such an abundance, as you say, of food, and we didn't have, and you know, we were too busy with publishing books or whatever. We didn't have the time to can it. It's way easier to freeze a lot of times, to just throw stuff in bags and pull it out when you want it. And I guess the other thing is when you do things like canning beans or something a few times, you realize that, man, you've got to cook those jars a long time, and you seem to cook a lot of nutrition out of them. Where I find with freezing, you can do it quickly and get them in there quickly. I think you actually end up preserving a lot more of the nutrients. So
I completely
that's
agree.
Definitely chest freezer. Chest freezer is a great idea. And, you know, remember, if you've got a big chest freezer somewhere and you have a power outage, you know, just make sure you find some big quilts and you throw them over that freezer and keep it closed. Don't be opening it during a power outage. You know, the longer it stays closed and covered, the longer it's going to keep your stuff cold. So, you know, that's one thing to think about with a freezer. That's not something you have to think about with a root cellar. It doesn't require the power. I do talk a bit about things like dehydration. And, you know, using sun drying and some of those things, maybe making fruit leathers, that's a good way to preserve some of that harvest. And pickling is a good thing, you know, and pickling is great with a lot of things. And, again, doesn't require as much energy. And jams and jellies, same idea if you've got, you know, your strawberries and raspberries and things that you're growing in the garden. I think really the key to any successful garden is going to be a good root cellar. And it's tough to think of with a lot of suburban homes, for instance. People think of it as a country thing, but maybe in a suburban house, you need to think of it more as a cold storage, and you need to think of taking an area of your basement that right now is already cool and making sure it's turning it into a root cellar. If you can, you'd want to put it, say, on the northwest corner. If it's below grade but there's a window in it, that's nice, because then you can use that window to build yourself a couple of vents, one that will allow fresh air to come in and drop down onto the floor of the root cellar, and then one that can vent it out the top. Because having air circulation is important, because you want to make sure that some of the gases, that some of the vegetables, as they're gradually breaking down over the winter, things like apples and stuff let off a gas that will make your carrots, ripen prematurely. So you want to have air circulation in there. So take an area of the basement, insulate it well, and make sure that there's no heating vents in it. And the optimal conditions for a root cellar are about 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 90 degrees or 90% humidity. And that's certainly something you don't want in most of your house. That's going to cause a problem. It's one of the things you should think about with your insulation on that cold storage when you make it. You're much better to go with, say, a rigid foam insulation than the typical fiberglass, because that's more likely to have mold and issues like that. But the temperature you want to aim for in that root cellar is about 40 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees Celsius and 90% humidity. Because a vegetable really is a large part of that vegetable is water. And the more humid it is, the longer it's going to get preserved. So, you know, in the fall as we're harvesting the garden, I'm putting potatoes into buckets. I throw in either sawdust or peat moss or dry sand, and I put a whack of them into the root cellar. My carrots I put into wet sawdust. They prefer to be a little damp in storage. I bought a bunch of wire mesh buckets, like trash can, like little trash cans that you have in an office. And that's what I put my onions in, and I hang those up so they're a little bit off the ground. I've got some metal shelving in there that I put all my squash on, and even some of the watermelons and things like that that are late. I might get three or four weeks out of before they go on me. So some of the stuff like squash isn't going to last you all winter, but it's the sort of stuff that it allows you to sort of extend the season and be making squash soup and some of those things into even January and February before those things start to go. And again, this is where your practicing is going to help. You know, there's been years that I have just grown so many squash, and I've just loaded up that root cellar with so many of these darn things. And by March, I had this big whack of moldy squash that are furry, and I don't even remember what they are. Because I don't eat enough of it, so you sort of get to a stage where you know how much you're realistically going to eat, and therefore how much of your root cellar should be devoted to the specific things that you're growing.
But on the root cellar type of storage, help out to people down here where I'm at. Our houses down here in Texas, especially this part of Texas, are not built with basements, and they never will be. Because if you dig more than, 3 inches past the little layer of topsoil they put the grass in when they put a house in here, you'll find this real dark black soil, which normally you think of as good until you dig it up here. And it's what they call gumbo clay. And basically, they build houses on slab foundations here so that they'll float, because that clay, when it rains, expands, and when it gets dry, it contracts, and it will literally crumble a house to the ground if you try to put a basement underneath it. So we ain't got any basements. It's not really a good place to dig something large and put a basement in. Any ideas for somebody in this environment that we can do for some level of similar type of storage?
Yeah, that's a tough one, Jack. I'd have to do more research on that.
Okay.
I did a presentation for the local gardening group here in the village near where I live, and it's quite amazing when you do some research on the internet the variety of root cellars that are out there and some of the designs that are there. I know I saw one that was in California, and I think it was probably I had seen it in a Mother Earth news. And it was very cool because they had done this lovely job of building soil up, they had a fairly large door in it, and had landscaped it nicely. So they it was just a little hill they put in their backyard, but they got enough soil in it that it was able to keep things cool in it.
Very cool.
Now it may not last as well as something in a cooler climate like I'm in. But certainly it's going to extend the season. But you have a much longer growing season.
Exactly.
Well,
that,
right?
That was what I was going to get at. There's a trade-off. If I can get my storage for me to go 3-4 months, that is like you getting 6. Because I've got, like I said, I'm sure you had to pull your peppers before Thanksgiving. So I don't need as long of storage. And then to me, if you get other storage methods going on, like you mentioned drying and dehydration, that's what we did with our peppers primarily. And we were able to take, the cloth shopping bags they have, the ones that you reuse. One of those completely full of bell peppers, when fully chopped up and dehydrated, fit into 3 1-pint paint cans, and I buy these paint cans with the FDA-approved gold lining, so they're food grade. 3 of those from, a 20-pound bag full of sweet peppers, and you're not going to eat salad with that. I mean, let's be honest, and they're not going to make a real good side dish like fried peppers or something, but for soups, for stews, for chilies, for anything like that, they're outstanding. So if you can, trade off certain things based on where you're at, I think is the best thing to do. I've also seen things where people build like a mini root cellar where they basically, dig a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot cube out of the ground and kind of do the cover over and lower things down. I've never tried it, so I can't vouch for how well it works, but I have to believe there would be some reasonable effect from anything subterranean. And remember, folks, when you do a root cellar, if you have a perfect environment, you can have dirt floor, right, Cam? Not a nice, pretty concrete, you know, slab down there.
Right, and one of the nice things about a dirt floor is the fact that it's going to actually serve as a way to regulate the humidity in the air. And if you had a particularly dry period, you could just go down and dump a bucket of water on your dirt floor or even a gravel floor, and then it would release that humidity gradually. So that's a great idea. I think one of the other things you touch on as well is in warmer climates, you can probably be more aggressive in sort of using a system of planting where you don't plant everything all at once, you stagger it. And so, you know, you get some potatoes and get some of everything in as early as you can, which obviously for you is going to be much earlier, but then you keep, you know, planting every two or three weeks during the season. And what you're going to learn as you're experimenting is that, you know, oh look, I know I can still get some potatoes in August. And those are the ones that I'm going to be able to harvest in November in my growing area based on, you know, how the nice thing about potatoes is they're growing below ground. So, I mean, they're still going to survive a frost down there without taking too much damage. So,
absolutely.
The more you get into, learning how to sort of stagger your plantings and do multiple plantings, you're going to find that's going to allow you to extend the season, and you're going to get stuff in early and get stuff in late and maximize the amount of time that you can be feeding yourself directly right out of the garden.
I think you're dead on. I mean, we have like a big line here that we cross over, and it's usually right around the time of the first frost. A month or two before that, I'm starting to do things like start broccoli and kale and lettuce and spinach and all the stuff that you can probably grow through most of your growing season, that if I put it in the ground here, it's either going to die or bolt and go to seed in like 15 days. And that's the time of the year that I can plant that stuff. So all of a sudden we go from tomatoes and peppers and, you know, summer squash and things like that and sweet potato. We make this cross to where most of what we're eating from the garden that's fresh is salad greens, onions and garlic and things like that as well. And we just change our diet as the season changes. I'm going to be more likely to sit down to a huge bowl of baby kale and arugula and spinach with maybe one store-bought pepper chopped up in it in December here, and maybe have broccoli with dinner than I am in August when I'm going to be eating peppers and tomatoes and squash. And it's just about living, you know, wherever you live, you kind of adapt to that. But like you've been saying, until people start to do it, you're not going to figure any of it out. And just because you see your neighbor doing something doesn't mean when times get tough, you'll just be able to flip the switch and start doing what he's doing, because that guy might have 10 or like you 14 years of soil building. And if somebody moved out to your farm area tomorrow and started trying to grow in that sandy soil with no organic improvements, they're not going to get the results that you have.
Yep, and every year you're going to, hopefully, I think what you'll find is you want to experiment. And what I'm increasingly doing is growing more warm season crops. Like, one year I had good luck with peanuts. Again, another way to grow some protein in your backyard. And I did mulch them. I used a black plastic mulch to really sort of accelerate the amount of heat that they got. And we're getting much better at growing sweet potatoes up here. You get some varieties that can handle the cooler growing season. And, I mean, sweet potatoes are just an absolute nutritional powerhouse. So good for you. And you always think of these things as something that grows in the tropics. But, you know, the last few years we've been growing them, and, they're great. I was never a big sweet potato fan until I started growing my own and realized that the kind you get from the store, basically, you know, to cure a sweet potato, you need to keep it warm. Whereas it arrives at your grocery store in a refrigerated truck. So it's no wonder it doesn't taste as good as it could if you pulled it out of your own garden.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as we go to wrap up here, you've got quite a few books out. You want to maybe tell folks about some of the things that they can get that will help them do these stuff from you, and, you know, your website. And you're even doing some workshops at your farm now, aren't you? Retreat or something like that, I read?
Yeah, we always, when I did workshops down at community colleges and stuff, I would usually have people come up because in the fall, because so many people you hear, oh, somebody lives off the grid, they sort of assume you've got an outhouse and you've got dirt floors. So, you know, I invite people up to come and flush my toilet and watch my my satellite television and see that you can do this, and you can live a typical North American lifestyle with renewable energy because the technology allows you to do it. So the Renewable Energy Handbook that we published by William Kemp, really, I think it takes you through the full gamut of how to make your house more efficient, and then how to look at all the different bits and pieces that you require with ideas to making it upgradable. The book that I wrote, Thriving During Challenging Times, subtitle is The Energy, Food, and Financial Independence Handbook. And I just sort of, I look at the big pictures of the economic collapse and climate change and what's going on with peak oil, and say the future is going to look much different than the present. You need to make yourself more resilient to shocks, and I take people through step by step on how to do that. And the All-You-Can-Eat Gardening Handbook is just where I share my 35 years of gardening experience. Gardening, it's easy, but I've just got some pointers that I've learned in my years that I share with people that I hope makes their journey to improving their gardening skills a little easier. You can get all our books at our website, which is aztext.com, aztext.com, or my website, cammather.com. And I certainly encourage you to get them from your local bookstore. They can order them. And I think that one of the things that I really like about my local community, and one of the things that I've found about living in a small town, is that I know everybody. I know all the merchants in town. And I think that, you know, one of the greatest ways you can prepare yourself for an uncertain future is to start building up a network of people that have skills and know as many people in your community as you can. And it's harder to do in the suburbs or the city, but you know, if you go into your local video store and your local grocery store, you need to get to know people. And I talk about, if you can't grow your own food, join a CSA, a community supported agriculture.
Absolutely.
Some of the farmers that supply food will invite you out to work on the weekends. So you may be in the city, you know, get out in the farm on the weekends and learn how to pull weeds and how to store carrots and stuff. So those things you can do as well. And one of the things you had mentioned to me earlier was just in terms of, you know, I'm off grid and I had communication has been my biggest challenge, and there wasn't any cell service here when we moved in, but we have it now. Our internet, we use high speed internet from a satellite, and that's it's more expensive than you would get in the city. But the first thing to investigate is whether there's wireless high speed in your area, because a lot of local governments are spending more and more money on bringing wireless high speed to rural environments. So that should be your first step. Find out if you can get that, and then you need to start looking at what sort of speed you can get out of a phone line if you have a landline, and then your last resort would be high speed internet through a satellite. More expensive, but it's just amazing how your life can change when you're in a rural environment and you've been using dial up, and suddenly you can do everything online and with high speed and a satellite. It's really changed our life and made living off grid in a rural environment much more contemporary. You're plugged into the matrix even though you're not, and it's very cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we've been looking at. I'm with you on the wireless stuff, and I think there's a technology called WiMAX that eventually is going to solve all these problems. It's not really rolled out yet. Motorola has a product called Canopy that they're trying to push into a lot of these rural environments, which I think people should look at, but it's not there yet. And then there's places like where I'm going off grid. It's not nice and flat. It's the terrain is very mountainous, and you know, there's only 12 people that live up in our set of the hills, and you know, getting a signal back in there even with WiMAX is difficult. So I'm going to be stuck with satellite. So in your experience, I'm fine with paying it because I need the connection as part of my business. Is it a good level of service, I guess, is my concern? And if you don't mind, can you say who you use for this?
Well, I use a company called ExploreNet, and I think they use Hughes satellites out of the U.S. I think, quite honestly, the one thing that people need to understand with satellite internet is the fact that you're going to have latency, and that's going to cause a problem when you want to use voice over IP or telephony, as it's sometimes called. So something like Skype. Skype won't really work well with satellite with the current technology because, you know, your voice is going to go, you know, 25,000 miles into space onto a satellite and then be, echoed back down 25,000 miles back down to Earth. So when you talk to somebody using Skype with high-speed satellite internet, you're going to find there's a delay there, which is very distracting. And I continue to talk to my satellite company, and I know they're working on it, but there still are some physical limitations because
Sure.
of the distance that's going.
The speed of light is the speed of light is the speed of light, and you can't go faster than that. And that's what you're talking with a radio satellite frequency wave. There, it's really a light wave, and it's not going to. The only way to make it go faster is to make the satellite lower, and that has its limitations too. Delay more than 2 seconds is generally intolerable, and you get around 4 to 6 seconds with satellite comms. So it's almost like being on a radio. When we did it in the military, the only way to have that conversation through sat relays was, you know, hey, Cam, how you doing? This is Jack. Over. And you had to be like you were on a radio and give the definitive end of your statement. Otherwise, if I pause for like half a second, you start talking, then the other half of my communication comes over, and now we're both – and then I'm going, no, I'm still talking, and it's dead. So, yeah, what about – I mean, my big concern is trying to upload a 20-megabyte – podcast for these folks every day, and figuring I might have to run down to town and hit the Starbucks Wi-Fi to do that.
Well, yeah, I mean that won't be a problem with satellite. You know,
okay.
I think cost us $100 a month, and we get 350 megabytes of data up or down, and so you know they have different packages, etc. So no, that won't be a problem. And I think, quite honestly, I think this latency problem will be dealt with. I mean, you can talk to somebody on the other side of the world on a phone with cables going under the ocean. So I mean, they have learned how to do it with echoing and delaying, and they have a number of techniques that they've used, you know, for a long time with traditional phones, and I think it will come on satellite. But that's one limitation we have right now. You know, my daughters live 4 hours away. You know, we once in a while we'll connect to them with Skype, which is nice because we can see their picture. But after about 5 minutes, we get tired of talking and then waiting, you know, because of the delay. So it's been fun, but, you know, we're not going to talk all afternoon.
Sure, sure. Very cool. Well, hey, Cam, I'll tell you what. I'm going to make sure that everybody can find your books, your websites, things like that. They'll all be in today's show notes for people. So all they have to do is go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, look up this episode. If you're listening to it 6 months from the time we recorded it, it's still there. Just search for episode 566 in the search box, and you'll be able to find this like light speed, honestly. And is there anything else maybe you want to leave people with, final thoughts or things like that?
No, I appreciate you having me on, Jack. I'm glad there's somebody out there doing what you're doing. I think that the more people that have these skills, the more and are mentally prepared for this, the more resilient we are going to be as a society. And I think there's going to be a lot of people very dazed and confused when things start happening. And I think that lots of us still have jobs, and lots of us still have an income, and we have an opportunity now to make ourselves more resilient to those shocks. And I think I can't urge people enough to get cracking, to start investing in some of this stuff.
And let me hear, as we wrap up here at the end, so I'll offer a personal endorsement for Cam's book. I've got all of his books, and I think they belong on your bookshelf, too. I mean, you guys know I don't recommend a book unless it's on my bookshelf, if I don't think of enough of it to keep it there. And it's got to be more than that. I get books sent to me all the time. Somebody sends me one, and when I finally get around to reading it, it doesn't meet muster. I still don't recommend it. Most books about these subjects, alternative energy and growing your own food and self-sufficiency, spend 80% of their text explaining to you why you should do it, and 20% explaining to you how to do it. My experience with Cam stuff is it gives you 80% of how and 20% of why, which to me is a hell of a lot more important, because I want to know what to do it, and how to get it done and how to make it work. So that's a personal endorsement for all of Cam's books. Again, I'll put links in the show notes. And with that, this has been Jack Spierko today here with Cam Mather, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouch for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.